The final word on imagination practice. It doesn't matter what religious, spiritual, or philosophical background or viewpoint you come from. It doesn't matter how you describe it. Imagination practice, visualization, mental picturing, or using my terminology, theater of your mind. What's important is that you do it. If you will choose a target to apply this to and give it a solid, honest 21-day trial, you will be so gratified with the results that you will certainly choose to continue using this tool for the rest of your life and benefit enormously by doing so, just as countless athletes, entertainers, doctors, lawyers, business leaders, and others have before you. Here are a few exercises to get you started. Try this mental training exercise. Your present self-image was built on your own imagination pictures of yourself in the past, which grew out of interpretations and evaluations you placed on experience. Now you are to use the same method to build an adequate self-image that you previously used to build an inadequate one. Set aside a period of 30 minutes each day where you can be alone and undisturbed. Relax, and make yourself as comfortable as possible. Now, close your eyes and exercise your imagination. Many people find they get better results if they imagine themselves sitting before a large motion picture screen and imagine that they are seeing a motion picture of themselves. The important thing is to make these pictures as vivid and as detailed as possible. You want your mental pictures to approximate actual experience as much as possible. The way to do this is to pay attention to small details, sights, sounds, objects in your imagined environment. Details of the imagined environment are all important in this exercise because for all practical purposes, you are creating a practice experience. And if the imagination is vivid enough and detailed enough, your imagination practice is equivalent to an actual experience, insofar as your nervous system is concerned. The next important thing to remember is that during these 30 minutes, you see yourself acting and reacting appropriately, successfully, ideally. It doesn't matter how you acted yesterday. You do not need to try to have faith you will act in the ideal way tomorrow. Your nervous system will take care of that in time, if you continue to practice. See yourself acting, feeling, being as you want to be. Do not say to yourself, I'm going to act this way tomorrow. Just say to yourself, I'm going to imagine myself acting this way now, for 30 minutes, today. Imagine how you would feel if you were already the sort of personality you want to be. If you've been shy and timid, see yourself moving among people with ease and poise, and feeling good because of it. If you've been fearful and anxious in certain situations, see yourself acting calmly and deliberately, acting with confidence and courage, and feeling expansive and confident, because you are. This exercise builds new memories or stored data in your midbrain and central nervous system. It builds a new image of self. After practicing it for a time, you will be surprised to find yourself acting differently, more or less automatically and spontaneously without trying. This is as it should be. You do not need to take thought or try or make an effort now in order to feel ineffective and act inadequately. Your present inadequate feeling and doing are automatic and spontaneous because of the memories, real and imagined, you have built into your automatic mechanism. You will find it will work just as automatically upon positive thoughts and experiences as upon negative ones. Step 1. Take pad and pen and write out a brief outline or description of the mental movie you intend to construct, experiment with, develop, and view in the theater in the mind. Step 2. Set aside 30 minutes a day, preferably at the same time each day, to find a quiet, private place, relax, close your eyes, enter your theater, and begin playing, editing, replaying your movie. Step 3. Gradually massage your movie so that its star, you, performs exactly as you desire and achieves the experience and results you desire. Strive to arrive at this point within the first 10 days. Step 4. For the remaining 11 days, play and enjoy that movie repeatedly, without change. Chapter 4. How to Dehypnotize Yourself from False Beliefs. Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche wrote, "Convictions are more dangerous enemies of truth than lies." A question that I have been asked many times about psychocybernetics equates as if imagination with fake it till you make it or pure fantasy. Nothing could be further from the truth. Fake it till you make it is external, superficial, and unrealistic. It is sometimes taught to salespeople to their financial and emotional detriment. Instead, Psychocybernetics, including as-if imagination practice, is not about fraud, but a search for hidden truth. It is about uncovering your true self by creatively challenging ideas your self-image accepts as facts about you that may or may not have been valid once, but need not be valid today or tomorrow. This story from my original book illustrates this. My friend, Dr. Alfred Adler, had an experience with a young boy that illustrates just how powerful belief can be on behavior and ability. He got off to a bad start in arithmetic, and his teacher became convinced that he was dumb in mathematics. The teacher then advised the parents of this fact and told them not to expect too much of him. They too were convinced. Adler passively accepted the evaluation they had placed on him, and his grades in arithmetic proved they had been correct. One day, however, he had a sudden flash of insight and thought he saw how to work a problem the teacher had put on the board and that none of the other pupils could work. He announced as much to the teacher. She and the whole class laughed, whereupon he became indignant, strode to the blackboard, and worked the problem, much to their amazement. In doing so, he realized that he could understand arithmetic. He felt a new confidence in his ability and went on to become a good math student. Dr. Adler's experience was very much like that of a patient of mine some years back, a business person who wanted to excel in public speaking because he had a vital message to impart about his outstanding success in a difficult field. He had a good voice and an important topic, but he was unable to get up in front of strangers and put his message over. What held him back was his belief that he could not make a good talk, and that he would fail to impress his audience simply because he did not have an imposing appearance. He did not look like a successful executive. This belief had burrowed so deeply into him that it threw up a roadblock every time he stood up before a group of people and began to talk. He mistakenly concluded that if he could have an operation to improve his appearance, he would then gain the confidence he needed. An operation might have done the trick, and it might not. My experience with other patients had shown that physical change did not always guarantee personality change. The solution in this man's case was found when he became convinced that his negative belief was preventing him from delivering the vital information he had. He succeeded in replacing the negative belief with a positive belief that he had a message of extreme importance that he alone could deliver, no matter what he looked like. In due time, he was one of the most sought-after speakers in the business world. The only change was in his belief and in his self-image. Now, the point I want to make is this. Adler had been hypnotized by a false belief about himself, not figuratively, but literally and actually hypnotized. Remember that we said in the last chapter that the power of hypnosis is the power of belief. Let me repeat here Dr. Barber's explanation of the power of hypnosis. Quote, "We found that hypnotic subjects are able to do surprising things only when convinced that the hypnotist's words are true statements. When the hypnotist has guided the subject to the point where he is convinced that the hypnotist's words are true statements, the subject then behaves differently because he thinks and believes differently." Unquote. The important thing for you to remember is that it does not matter in the least how you got the idea or where it came from. You may never have met a professional hypnotist. You may have never been formally hypnotized. But if you've accepted an idea from yourself, your teachers, your parents, friends, advertisements, or any other source, and further, if you are firmly convinced that idea is true, it has the same power over you as the hypnotist's words have over the hypnotized subject. Scientific research has shown that Dr. Adler's experience was not one in a million, but typical of practically all students who make poor grades. In Chapter 1, we told of how Prescott Leckie had brought about almost miraculous improvement in the grades of schoolchildren by showing them how to change their self-image. After thousands of experiments and many years of research, Leckie concluded that poor grades in school are in almost every case due in some degree to students' self-conception and self-definition. These students had been literally hypnotized by such ideas as, "I am dumb, I am poor in arithmetic, I am a naturally poor speller, I do not have a mechanical type mind," etc. With such self-definitions, students had to make poor grades in order to be true to themselves. Unconsciously, making poor grades became a moral issue with them. It would be as wrong, from their viewpoint, for them to make good grades as it would be to steal if they defined themselves as honest persons. Remember that this hypnotic programming gains permanence by coming from an authoritative source, through repetition and through intensity. Deprogramming and reprogramming requires you to provide these very same factors. Dr. Adler's childhood experience included authoritative sources, his parents and teachers. Hearing it repeatedly, and having it reinforced through intensely humiliating experience. His liberation began with another intense experience and emotional reaction, which freed him and motivated him to question and challenge the belief. The Case of the Hypnotized Salesperson. In the book, Secrets of Successful Selling, John D. Murphy tells how the famous sales expert Elmer Wheeler used Leckie's theory to increase the earnings of a certain salesperson. Quote, Elmer Wheeler had been called in as a sales consultant to a certain firm. The sales manager called his attention to a very remarkable case. A certain salesman always managed to make almost exactly $5,000 per year regardless of the territory they assigned him or the commission he was paid. Because this salesman had done well in a rather small territory, he'd been given a larger and much better one. But the next year, his commission amounted to almost the same amount as that he had made in the smaller one, $5,000. The following year, the company increased the commission paid to all salesmen, but this salesman still managed to make only $5,000. He was then assigned one of the company's poorest territories, and again made the usual $5,000. Wheeler had a talk with this salesman and found that the trouble was not in the territory, but in the salesman's own evaluation of himself. He thought of himself as a $5,000 per year man, and as long as he held that concept of himself, outside conditions didn't seem to matter much. When he was assigned a poor territory, he worked hard to make that $5,000. When he was assigned a good territory, he found all sorts of excuses to coast when the $5,000 was in sight. Once, when the goal had been reached, he got sick and was unable to work any more that year, although doctors could find nothing wrong with him, and he miraculously recovered by the first of the next year. Unquote. Obviously, that's an old story, dated by the $5,000 earnings number. After it appeared in the first edition of this book, I began to get letters about this story from sales manager after sales manager, each citing a similar story. They all would say that they had a person just like that in their organization with whom they were frustrated beyond all belief. One sales manager wrote, "It is as if Howard has a preset income limit that he will not go past no matter the opportunities or circumstances." And that is exactly right. It is set, deep in his self-image. Until it is reset, he will manage to avoid going past it. How a False Belief Aged a Man 20 Years. In my previous book, Adventures in Staying Young, I gave a detailed case history of how Mr. Russell aged 20 years almost overnight because of a false idea, then regained his youth almost as quickly when he accepted the truth. Briefly, the story is this. I performed a cosmetic operation on Mr. Russell's lower lip for a very modest fee, under the condition that he must tell his girlfriend that the operation had cost him his entire lifetime savings. His girlfriend had no objection to his spending money on her, and she insisted that she loved him, but explained she could never marry him because of his too large lower lip. However, when he told her this and proudly exhibited his new lower lip, her reaction was just as I had expected, but not as Mr. Russell had anticipated. She became hysterically angry, called him a fool for having spent all his money, and advised him in no uncertain terms that she had never loved him and never would. She had merely played him for a sucker as long as he had the money to spend on her. However, she went further than I had counted on. In her anger and disgust, she also announced that she was placing a voodoo curse on him. Both Mr. Russell and his girlfriend had been born on an island in the West Indies where voodoo was practiced by the ignorant and superstitious. His family had been rather well-to-do. His background was one of culture, and he was a college graduate. When, in the heat of anger, his girlfriend cursed him, he felt vaguely uncomfortable but did not think too much about it. However, he remembered and wondered when a short time later he felt a strange, small, hard bump on the inside of his lip. A friend, who knew of the voodoo curse, insisted that he see a Dr. Smith, who promptly assured him that the bump inside his mouth was the feared African bug, which would slowly eat away all his vitality and strength. Mr. Russell began to worry and look for signs of waning strength. He was not long in finding them. He lost his appetite and his ability to sleep. I learned all this from Mr. Russell when he returned to my office several weeks after I had dismissed him. My nurse didn't recognize him, and no wonder. The Mr. Russell who had first called upon me had been a very impressive individual, slightly too large lip and all. He stood about 6'4", a large man with the physique of an athlete and the bearing and manner that bespoke an inner dignity and gave him a magnetic personality. The very pores of his skin seemed to exude an animal-like vitality. The Mr. Russell who now sat across the desk from me had aged at least 20 years. His hand shook with the tremor of age, his eyes and cheeks were sunken, he had lost perhaps 30 pounds, The changes in his appearance were all characteristic of the process that medical science, for want of a better name, calls aging. After a quick examination of his mouth, I assured Mr. Russell I could get rid of the African bug in less than 30 minutes, which I did. The bump, which had caused all the trouble, was merely a small bit of scar tissue from his operation. I removed it, held it in my hand, and showed it to him. The important thing is he saw the truth and believed it. He gave a sigh of relief, and it seemed as if there was an almost immediate change in his posture and expression. Several weeks later, I received a nice letter from Mr. Russell, together with a photograph of him with his new bride. He had gone back to his home and married his childhood sweetheart. The man in the picture was the first Mr. Russell. Mr. Russell had grown young again overnight. A false belief had aged him 20 years. The truth had not only set him free of fear and restored his confidence, but had actually reversed the aging process. If you could have seen Mr. Russell as I did, both before and after, you would never again entertain any doubts about the power of belief, or that an idea accepted as true from any source can be every bit as powerful as hypnosis. Is everyone hypnotized? It is no exaggeration to say that all human beings are hypnotized to some extent, either by ideas they have uncritically accepted from others, or by ideas they have repeated to themselves or convinced themselves are true. These negative ideas have exactly the same effect on our behavior as the negative ideas implanted into the mind of a hypnotized subject by a professional hypnotist. Have you ever seen a demonstration of honest-to-goodness hypnosis? If not, let me describe just a few of the more simple phenomena that result from the hypnotist's suggestion. The hypnotist tells a strong football player that his hand is stuck to the table and that he cannot lift it. It is not a question of the football player not trying. He simply cannot. He strains and struggles until the muscles of his arm and shoulder stand out like cords, but his hand remains fully rooted to the table. He tells the championship weightlifter that he cannot lift a pencil from the desk, and although normally he can hoist a 400-pound weight overhead, he now actually cannot lift the pencil. Strangely enough, in these instances, hypnosis does not weaken the athletes. They are potentially as strong as ever, but without realizing it consciously, they are working against themselves. On the one hand, they try to lift their hand or the pencil by voluntary effort, and actually contract the proper lifting muscles. But on the other hand, the idea, "You cannot do it," causes contrary muscles to contract quite apart from their will. The negative idea causes them to defeat themselves. They cannot express or bring into play their actual available strength. The gripping strength of another athlete has been tested on a dynamometer and has been found to be 100 pounds. All his effort and straining cannot budge the needle beyond the 100-pound mark. Now he is hypnotized and told, "You are very, very strong. Stronger than you have ever been in your life. Much, much stronger. You are surprised at how strong you are." Again, the gripping strength of his hand is tested. This time he easily pulls the needle to the 125-pound mark. Again, strangely enough, hypnosis has not added anything to his actual strength. What the hypnotic suggestion did was to overcome a negative idea that had previously prevented him from expressing his full strength. In other words, the athlete, in his normal waking state, had imposed a limitation on his strength by the negative belief that he could only grip 100 pounds. The hypnotist merely removed this mental block and allowed him to express his true strength. The hypnosis literally de-hypnotized him temporarily from his own self-limiting beliefs about himself. As Dr. Barber has said, it is awfully easy to assume that the hypnotist himself must have some magical power when you see rather miraculous things happen during a hypnotic session. The stutterer talks fluently. The timid, shy, retiring Casper Milktoast becomes outgoing, poised, and makes a stirring speech. Another individual who is not especially good in adding figures with a pencil and paper when awake multiplies 2 3-digit figures in his head. All this happens because the hypnotist tells them that they can, and instructs them to go ahead and do it. To onlookers, the hypnotist's word seems to have a magical power. Such, however, is not the case. The power, the basic ability to do these things, was inherent in the subjects all the time, before they met the hypnotist. The subjects, however, were unable to use this power because they themselves did not know it was there. They had bottled it up and choked it off because of their own negative beliefs. Without realizing it, they had hypnotized themselves into believing they could not do these things. And it would be truer to say that the hypnotist had de-hypnotized them than to say he had hypnotized them. Within you, whoever you may be, is the ability and the power to do whatever you need to do to be happy and successful. Within you right now is the power to do things you never dreamed possible. This power becomes available to you just as soon as you can change your beliefs. Just as quickly as you can de-hypnotize yourself from the ideas of, I can't, I'm not worthy, I don't deserve it, and other self-limiting ideas. You can cure your inferiority complex. At least 95% of people have their lives blighted by feelings of inferiority to some extent. And to millions, this same feeling of inferiority is a serious handicap to success and happiness. Every person on the face of the earth is inferior to some other person's or person. I know that I cannot beat Jack Nicklaus on the links, throw a football as straight and far as any NFL pro quarterback, and the list goes on. Even though I have appeared as a speaker in front of a number of large audiences, I know there's a long list of people who are more polished and stylish and charismatic on the platform. I know this, but it does not induce feelings of inferiority within me and blight my life, simply because I do not compare myself unfavorably with them, and do not feel that I am no good merely because I cannot do certain things as skillfully or as well as they. I also know that in certain areas, every person I meet, from the newsboy on the corner to the president of the bank, is superior to me in certain respects. But neither can any of these people repair a scarred face, or do any number of other things as well as I. And I'm sure they do not feel inferior because of it. Feelings of inferiority originate not so much from facts or experiences, but from our conclusions regarding facts and our evaluation of experiences. For example, the fact is that I am an inferior golfer to Jack Nicklaus or Arnold Palmer. This does not, however, make me an inferior person. Arnold Palmer's inability to perform surgery makes him an inferior surgeon, but not an inferior person. It all depends on what and whose norms we measure ourselves by. It is not knowledge of actual inferiority in skill or knowledge that gives us an inferiority complex and interferes with our living. It is the feeling of inferiority that does this. And this feeling of inferiority comes about for just one reason. We judge ourselves and measure ourselves not against our own norm or par, but against some other individual's norm. When we do this, we always, without exception, come out second best. But because we think and believe and assume that we should measure up to some other person's norm, we feel miserable and second rate and conclude that there is something wrong with us. The next logical conclusion in this cockeyed reasoning process is to conclude that we are not worthy, that we do not deserve success and happiness, and that it would be out of place for us to fully express our own abilities and talents, whatever they might be, without apology or without feeling guilty about it. All this comes about because we have allowed ourselves to be hypnotized by the entirely erroneous idea that I should be like so-and-so or I should be like everybody else. The fallacy of the second idea can be readily seen through, if analyzed, for in truth there are no fixed standards common to everybody else. Everybody else is composed of individuals, no two of whom are alike. Neither a new nose or new shoes guarantee success. Consider the famous advertising campaign constructed around Michael Jordan with the slogan, "I want to be like Mike." The blunt truth is that very few young men have the physical talent to replicate Michael Jordan's performance, even if they replicated his remarkable discipline, commitment, work ethic, and competitive spirit. If this ad campaign harmlessly sells shoes and clothing, so be it. For some, it will serve as positive stimulus and motivation to strive to achieve, and that is constructive. For others, however, sadly, it will serve only to set up an impossible ideal to compare to, or worse, send young people away from the core to the circumference of being. Guaranteed disappointment when they discover that a new pair of shoes has no more magic than a new nose provided by my scalpel. The more mature, intelligent observer of Michael and of this ad campaign can choose not to be adversely hypnotized by it, but to be motivated by it and look past it more thoughtfully at the characteristics and behavior other than innate exceptional physical talent that have contributed most to Michael Jordan's success that may be uncovered in oneself, strengthened, even emulated. It is even true that a basketball player less innately physically gifted than Jordan could replicate or even surpass his success in the sport and do so in part thanks to Jordan as inspiration. The person with an inferiority complex invariably compounds the error by striving for superiority. Her feelings spring from the false premise that she is inferior. From this false premise, a whole structure of logical thought and feeling is built. If she feels bad because she is inferior, the cure is to make herself as good as everybody else, and the way to feel really good is to make herself superior. This striving for superiority gets her into more trouble, causes more frustration, and sometimes brings about a neurosis where none existed before. She becomes more miserable than ever, and the harder she tries, the more miserable she becomes. Inferiority and superiority are reverse sides of the same coin. The cure lies in realizing that the coin itself is spurious. The truth about you is this: you are not inferior. You are not superior. You are simply you. You, as a personality, are not in competition with any other personality simply because there is not another person on the face of the earth like you or in your particular class. You are an individual. You are unique. You are not like any other person and can never become like any other person. You are not supposed to be like any other person, and no other person is supposed to be like you. God did not create a standard person and in some way label that person by saying, "This is it." He made every human being individual and unique, just as he made every snowflake individual and unique. God created short people and tall people, large people and small people, skinny people and fat people, black, yellow, red, and white people. He has never indicated any preference for any one size, shape, or color. Abraham Lincoln once said, "God must have loved the common people, for he made so many of them." He was wrong. There is no common man, no standardized common pattern. Lincoln would have been nearer the truth had he said, "God must have loved uncommon people, for he made so many of them." An inferiority complex and its accompanying deterioration in performance can be made to order in the psychological laboratory. All you need to do is set up a norm or average, then convince your subject he does not measure up. In my original book, I reported on a psychologist who wanted to find out how feelings of inferiority affected the ability to solve problems. He gave his students a set of routine tests. To quote from the February 1952 issue of Science Digest, the article, "What's on Your Mind?" But then he solemnly announced that the average person could complete the test in about one-fifth the time it would really take. When in the course of the test a bell would ring indicating that the average man's time was up, some of the brightest subjects became very jittery and incompetent indeed, thinking themselves to be morons. Unquote. Imagine, if you didn't know any better, being taken to the golf course for the first time, shown the basics of the game, and told that the average new player hit 80. If you were convinced that this was true, how would you feel at the conclusion of your first round of golf? Or imagine, if you didn't know any better, if you were to enter the insurance business convinced that the average new agent instantly began making $20,000 a month in commissions, how would you feel at the conclusion of the first month, the second? Consider also the dangers of measuring yourself against a very unfair apples-to-oranges standard. For example, if I were to measure my worth as an author by comparing my book's number of copies sold to novelists Tom Clancy or Stephen King, I would be comparing apples to oranges. Stop measuring yourself against their standards. You are not them and can never measure up. Neither can they measure up to your standards, nor should they. As you utilize psychocybernetics to communicate with your self-image, your objective should not be to feel superior to others, nor should you continue permitting feelings of inferiority to others. Your objective is to develop your own unique personality and accomplishments. How to use relaxation to dehypnotize yourself. Physical relaxation plays a key role in the dehypnotization process. Our currently held beliefs, whether good or bad, true or false, were formed without effort, with no sense of strain, and without the exercise of willpower. Our habits, whether good or bad, were formed in the same way. It follows that we must employ the same process in forming new beliefs or new habits, that is, in a relaxed condition. Physical relaxation, when practiced daily, brings about an accompanying mental relaxation and a relaxed attitude, which enables us to better consciously control our automatic mechanism. Physical relaxation also, in itself, has a powerful influence in dehypnotizing us from negative attitudes and reaction patterns. Try this mental training exercise to be practiced for at least 30 minutes daily. Seat yourself comfortably in an easy chair or lie down on your back. Consciously let go the various muscle groups as much as possible without making too much of an effort of it. Just consciously pay attention to the various parts of your body and let go a little. You will find that you can always voluntarily relax to a certain degree. You can stop frowning and let your forehead relax. You can ease up a little on the tension in your jaws. You can let your hands, your arms, your shoulders, your legs become a little more relaxed than they are. Spend about 5 minutes on this, and then stop paying any attention to your muscles. This is as far as you are going to try to go by conscious control. From here on, you will relax more and more by using your creative mechanism to automatically bring about a relaxed condition. In short, you are going to use goal pictures held in your imagination and let your automatic mechanism realize those goals for you. Mental picture 1. In your mind's eye, see yourself lying stretched out upon the bed. Form a picture of your legs as they would look if made of concrete. See yourself lying there with two very heavy concrete legs. See these very heavy concrete legs sinking far down into the mattress from their sheer weight. Now picture your arms and hands as made of concrete. They also are very heavy and are sinking down into the bed and exerting tremendous pressure against the bed. In your mind's eye, see a friend come into the room and attempt to lift your heavy concrete legs. He takes hold of your feet and attempts to lift them, but they're too heavy for him. He cannot do it. Repeat this process with your arms, neck, etc. Mental picture 2. Your body is a big marionette doll. Your hands are tied loosely to your wrists by strings. Your forearm is connected loosely by a string to your upper arm. Your upper arm is connected very loosely by a string to your shoulder. Your feet, calves, thighs are also connected together with a single string. Your neck consists of one very limp string. The strings that control your jaw and hold your lips together have slackened and stretched to such an extent that your chin has dropped down loosely against your chest. All the various strings connecting the various parts of your body are loose and limp, and your body is just sprawled loosely across the bed. Mental picture 3. Many people will find this the most relaxing of all. Just go back in memory to some relaxing and pleasant scene from your past. There is always some time in everyone's life when he felt relaxed, at ease, and at peace with the world. Pick out your own relaxing picture from your past and call up detailed memory images. Yours may be a peaceful scene at a mountain lake where you went fishing. If so, pay particular attention to the little incidental things in the environment. Remember the quiet ripples on the water. What sounds were present? Did you hear the quiet rustling of the leaves? Maybe you remember sitting perfectly relaxed and somewhat drowsy before an open fireplace long ago. Did the logs crackle and spark? What other sights and sounds were present? Maybe you choose to remember relaxing in the sun on a beach. How did the sand feel against your body? Could you feel the warm, relaxing sun touching your body almost as a physical thing? Was there a breeze blowing? Were there gulls on the beach? The more of these incidental details you can remember and picture to yourself, the more successful you will be. Daily practice will bring these mental pictures or memories clearer and clearer. The effect of learning will also be cumulative. Practice will strengthen the tie-in between mental image and physical sensation. You will become more and more proficient in relaxation, and this in itself will be remembered in future practice sessions. Chapter 5. How to Succeed with the Power of Rational Thinking. Bernard Baruch wrote, "I get the facts, I study them patiently, I apply imagination." Many of my patients were plainly disappointed when I prescribed something as simple as using their God-given power of reason as a method of changing negative beliefs and behavior. To some, it seemed incredibly naive and unscientific. Yet it does have one advantage. It works. And as we shall see later, it is based on sound scientific findings. There is a widely accepted fallacy that rational, logical, conscious thinking has no power over unconscious processes or mechanisms, and that to change negative beliefs, feelings, or behavior, it is necessary to dig down and dredge up material from the unconscious. Your automatic mechanism is absolutely impersonal. It operates as a machine and has no will of its own. It always tries to react appropriately to your current beliefs and interpretations concerning environment. It always seeks to give you appropriate feelings and to accomplish the goals that you consciously determine upon. It works only on the data that you feed it in the form of ideas, beliefs, interpretations, opinions. It is conscious thinking that is the control knob of your unconscious machine. It was by conscious thought, though perhaps irrational and unrealistic, that the unconscious machine developed its negative and inappropriate reaction patterns. And it is by conscious rational thought that the automatic reaction patterns can be changed. You can get positive results now. In movies and television programs, therapy is usually portrayed as a psychiatrist guiding a patient into an archaeological dig of distant childhood memories. As a result, it is a popular notion that once in therapy, you stay in therapy. I recall an executive telling me that he had many issues he would like to work on and behavior he would like to change, but that he would never agree to go to a psychiatrist's office week after week, dredging up and endlessly discussing matters from his childhood. With all due respect to psychiatrists, theirs is not the only path to a healthy self-image, and to be fair, this idea of psychiatry is not accurately representative of all doctors' methods. In any case, I asked the executive if he would seriously like to make some changes, if he could do it without ever having to revisit his childhood. When he said yes, I talked with him about the ideas in this chapter, the use of current rational thought in concert with the imagination to modify the self-image. Remember the formula you heard earlier? 1. Conscious mind decision plus 2. Imagination that communicates a goal or target to 3. Your self-image equals 4. Work order, instructions to your servo mechanism. Now we will simply add a precursor to the formula so that it becomes you as creator of your own life experiences. Rational thinking leads to 1. Conscious mind decision plus 2. Imagination that communicates a goal or target to 3, your self-image, equals 4, work order, instructions to your servo mechanism. In simple terms, sticking to the guided missile analogy central to psychocybernetics, we use deliberate, rational, conscious thought to choose the target. Then we use the imagination to communicate the target to the self-image in a manner that it will be accepted and acted upon. How testing self-imposed limits with rational thinking can surprise you. Consider a very simple situation: likes and dislikes of food. I once had a friend who refused to ever eat green beans and bacon, a side dish I enjoyed immensely, often with a good steak. Many times I tried to get him to try some, but he insisted that he hated beans. Finally, I wore him down, and one evening in a restaurant where we were sharing a meal, he grudgingly agreed to taste "your damn beans," as he put it, "just to get you off my back." After his first bite, he murmured, "Hmm." He tried a second bite, and a third. He said, "These are quite tasty." Some months later, when we again dined together, he ordered green beans with bacon. Now, there was some reason he believed it to be fact that he did not like the taste of green beans. I don't know the reason, and I don't know if he did either. I'd suppose not, since he never enunciated it. but he didn't need to ferret through his childhood experiences, holding all manner of youthful experiences up to the light, contemplating overheard adult conversations while hiding on the stairs, in order to challenge his belief and test it in his adult life, in the current moment. Admittedly, few psychologic issues are as innocuous as a like or dislike of green beans and bacon, but many ways in which you might desire to improve or to feel more at peace with yourself are actually not all that much more complex than your taste for beans either. I maintain, acknowledging that members of the psychiatric profession may differ, that most people can, in fact, resolve most of the self-sabotage plaguing them with psychocybernetics and possibly other related self-improvement modalities without in-depth analysis of all prior life events. It may be perfectly okay to let sleeping dogs lie. The fact that buried in the unconscious are memories of past failures along with unpleasant and painful experiences does not mean that these must be dug out, exposed, or examined in order to effect personality changes. As we pointed out earlier, all skill learning is accomplished by trial and error. By making a trial, missing the mark, consciously remembering the degree of error, and making correction on the next trial, until finally a hit or successful attempt is accomplished. The successful reaction pattern is then remembered or recalled and imitated on future trials. This is true for a man learning to pitch horseshoes, throw darts, sing, drive a car, play golf, get along socially with other human beings, or any other skill. Thus, all servo mechanisms, by their very nature, contain memories of past errors, failures, painful and negative experiences. These negative experiences do not inhibit, but contribute to the learning process. As long as they are used properly as negative feedback data and are seen as deviations from the positive goal desired. However, as soon as the error has been recognized as such and correction of course made, it is equally important that the error be consciously forgotten and the successful attempt remembered and dwelt upon. These memories of past failures do no harm as long as our conscious thought and attention is focused on the positive goal to be accomplished. Therefore, it is best to let these sleeping dogs lie. Our errors, mistakes, failures, and sometimes even our humiliations were necessary steps in the learning process. However, they were meant to be a means to an end, not an end in themselves. When they have served their purpose, they should be forgotten. If we consciously dwell on the error, or consciously feel guilty about the error and keep berating ourselves because of it, then, unwittingly, we make the error or failure itself the goal that is consciously held in imagination and memory. The unhappiest of mortals are those who insist on reliving the past over and over in their imagination, continually criticizing themselves for past mistakes, continually condemning themselves for past sins. The new term for taking control of your emotions and self-image without probing your past for root causes is solution-oriented therapy. And if you are interested in a current book on this subject, I recommend Do One Thing Different by Bill O'Hanlon. The power of forgetfulness. When asked to name the most important characteristic of a truly great pass receiver in football, the great quarterback of the Cleveland Browns, Otto Graham, said, "A damn short memory." Players and coaches have explained that to me and echoed it year after year in media interviews. What is meant is that the most important skill a receiver possesses is the ability to instantly forget about the catchable pass he just embarrassingly dropped so as to focus on the target, successfully catching the next one thrown in his direction. I have many times watched a football game on television, seen the field goal kicker hook a kick badly and miss a short 20 or 30-yard field goal, only to return later in the game, even with the entire game on the line, and make a much longer, more difficult field goal. The kicker's ability to forget and refocus was every bit as important as his physical strength and kicking mechanics. Continually criticizing yourself for past mistakes and errors, whether from years ago or minutes ago, does not help matters, but on the other hand, tends to perpetuate the very behavior you would change. Memories of past failures can adversely affect present performance if we dwell on them, and foolishly conclude, "I failed yesterday, therefore I will fail again today." However, this does not prove that unconscious reaction patterns have any power in themselves to repeat and perpetuate themselves, or that all buried memories of failure must be eradicated before behavior can be changed. If we are victimized, it is by our conscious thinking mind,
and not by the unconscious.
For it is with the thinking part of our personality that we draw conclusions and select the goal images that we shall concentrate on. The minute that we change our minds and stop giving power to the past, with its mistakes, loses its power over us. Ignore past failures and forge ahead. When a shy, timid wallflower is told in hypnosis and believes or thinks that he is a bold, self-confident orator, his reaction patterns are changed instantly. He currently acts as he currently believes. His attention is given over completely to the positive desired goal, and no thought or consideration whatsoever is given to past failures. Dorothea Brand tells in her charming book, Wake Up and Live, how this one idea enabled her to become more productive and successful as a writer and to draw upon talents and abilities she never knew she had. She had been both curious and amazed after witnessing a demonstration in hypnosis. Then she happened to read one sentence written by psychologist F. M. H. Myers, which she says changed her whole life. The sentence by Myers explained that the talents and abilities displayed by hypnotic subjects were due to a purgation of memory of past failures while in the hypnotic state. If this were possible under hypnosis, Dorothea Brand asked herself, if ordinary people carried around within themselves talents, abilities, powers that were held in check and not used merely because of memories of past failures, why couldn't a person in the wakeful state use these same powers by ignoring past failures and acting as if it were impossible to fail? She determined to try it. She would act on the assumption that the powers and abilities were there and that she could use them, if only she would go ahead and act as if, instead of in a tentative, half-hearted way. Within a year, her production as a writer had increased many times. So had her sales. A rather surprising result was that she discovered a talent for public speaking, became much in demand as a lecturer, and enjoyed it, whereas previously she had not only shown no talent for lecturing, but disliked it intensely. With psychocybernetics exercises like those described in many chapters in this program, as well as even more extensive and sophisticated mental training exercises provided in my 12-week course on psychocybernetics, one of the things I strive for is equipping you with ways to act as if within your own imagination and to encourage your doing so repetitively and creatively. Bertrand Russell's method. In his book, The Conquest of Happiness, Bertrand Russell wrote, I was not born happy. As a child, my favorite hymn was, Weary of earth and laden with my sin. In adolescence, I hated life and was continually on the verge of suicide, from which, however, I was restrained by the desire to know more mathematics. Now, on the contrary, I enjoy life. I might almost say that with every year that passes, I enjoy it more. Very largely, it is due to a diminishing preoccupation with myself. Like others who had a Puritan education, I had the habit of meditating on my sins, follies, and shortcomings. I seemed to myself, no doubt justly, a miserable specimen. Gradually, I learned to be indifferent to myself and my deficiencies. I came to center my attention increasingly upon external objects, the state of the world, various branches of knowledge, individuals for whom I felt affection. Unquote. In the same book, he describes his method for changing automatic reaction patterns based on false beliefs. Quote, it is quite possible to overcome infantile suggestions of the unconscious and even to change the contents of the unconscious by employing the right kind of technique. Whenever you begin to feel remorse for an act which your reason tells you is not wicked, examine the causes of your feeling of remorse and convince yourself in detail of their absurdity. Let your conscious beliefs be so vivid and emphatic that they make an impression upon your unconscious strong enough to cope with the impressions made by your nurse or your mother when you were an infant. Do not be content with an alternation between moments of rationality and moments of irrationality. Look into the irrationality closely with a determination not to respect it and not to let it dominate you. Whenever it thrusts foolish thoughts or feelings into your consciousness, pull them up by the roots, examine them, and reject them. Do not allow yourself to remain a vacillating creature, swayed half by reason and half by infantile folly. But if the rebellion is to be successful in bringing individual happiness and in enabling a man to live consistently by one standard, not to vacillate between two, it is necessary that he should think and feel deeply about what his reason tells him. Most men, when they have thrown off superficially the superstitions of their childhood, think that there is no more to be done. They do not realize that these superstitions are still lurking underground. When a rational conviction has been arrived at, it is necessary to dwell upon it, to follow out its consequences, to search out in oneself whatever beliefs inconsistent with the new conviction might otherwise survive. What I suggest is that a man should make up his mind with emphasis as to what he rationally believes, and should never allow contrary irrational beliefs to pass unchallenged or obtain a hold over him, however brief. This is a question of reasoning with himself in those moments in which he is tempted to become infantile. But the reasoning, if it is sufficiently emphatic, may be very brief. Unquote. Ideas are changed not by will, but by other ideas. It can be seen that Bertrand Russell's technique of searching out ideas that are inconsistent with some deeply felt conviction is essentially the same as the method tested clinically with such amazing success by Prescott Leckie. Leckie's method consisted of getting subjects to see that some negative concept of theirs was inconsistent with some other deeply held belief. Leckie believed that it was inherent in the very nature of mind itself that all ideas and concepts making up the total content of personality must seem to be consistent with each other. If the inconsistency of a given idea is consciously recognized, it must be rejected. In my original book, I told of my encounter with a salesperson in which I employed this technique of shining the spotlight on two conflicting beliefs to get rid of the unproductive one. One of my patients was a salesperson who was scared to death when calling on big shots. His fear and nervousness were overcome in just one counseling session during which I asked him, "Would you physically get down on all fours and crawl into the man's office, prostrating yourself before a superior personage?" "I should say not," he bristled. "Then why do you mentally cringe and crawl?" Another question: "Would you go into a man's office with your hand out like a beggar and beg for a dime for a cup of coffee?" "Certainly not." "Can't you see that you are doing essentially the same thing when you go in overly concerned with whether or not he will approve of you? Can't you see that you have your hand out, literally begging for his approval and acceptance of you as a person?" Two psychologic levers you can use to remove any mountain in your way. Leckie found that there were two powerful levers for changing beliefs and concepts. There are standard convictions, which are strongly held by nearly everyone. These are, 1, the feeling or belief that you are capable of doing your share, holding up your end of the log, exerting a certain amount of independence, and 2, the belief that there is something inside you that should not be allowed to suffer indignities. Interestingly, neurolinguistic programming, or NLP, which is based on extensive work by Drs. Grindler and Bandler and has been popularized by Tony Robbins, offers a toolkit of two items: pain and accomplishment. I do not think it coincidental that pain and the deep-seated belief that you should not suffer great indignities are the triggers that most quickly or easily and definitively motivate people to action. Knowing this, you can use it to motivate yourself to constructive action. Let me tell you of a person just so motivated. Today, Jeff Paul, one of the members of the Psycho-Cybernetics Foundation's board of directors and a co-author of the Psycho-Cybernetics book Zero Resistance Selling, was once a certified financial planner with some significant success, but horribly unhappy in his work. He disliked the commute to the office, wearing a suit and tie, selling on the telephone and in person, and the repetitive nature of the work. One day, he had the flash of rational thought that he need not continue making his living doing something he intensely disliked doing. He correctly, consciously acknowledged there must be any number of other ways he could meet his financial goals. You know, a great many people never take that simple realization seriously. Jeff then set about doing what we now call backwards goal setting. He mentally prepared a list of things he did not want to do at all. His list included having to wear a suit and tie, having to manage a staff, some dozen or so items in total. Then he utilized his imagination to shop around for ideas about other careers and businesses that he might have some affinity for, but that would never require him to do the things on his "I never want to do these things again" list. After considerable thought, he decided upon the mail order business. He recognized that a great many financial planners could benefit from the methods he had perfected for successfully attracting clients. He envisioned a business in which he would publish that information in the form of books, manuals, and recordings, then sell the products to members of his profession by advertising and direct mail. He could operate from an office in his home, and have functions like order-taking, printing, and shipping done for him by outside contractors. He convinced his self-image he could do this by focusing on his strengths, such as his intimate knowledge of the desires and frustrations of his peers, his possession of useful knowledge to sell, his evolving avid interest in mail order, and willingness to learn. While his earliest attempts were markedly unsuccessful, he course-corrected by a number of means and ultimately achieved extraordinary success, I will briefly enumerate here. First, Jeff built a mail-order publishing business selling to financial planners and insurance agents that provided an income of more than $100,000 a month from a small home office. Second, Jeff created a home study course, seminar, and other materials to teach his mail-order business model to others, and he has thus inspired many others to create such businesses. A book he wrote about his experiences to promote his course, How to Make $4,000 a Day Sitting at Your Kitchen Table in Your Underwear, has sold well over 100,000 copies. Third, he developed such a high level of marketing and sales letter copywriting skills that he has become a much sought-after, highly paid consultant. Maybe most importantly, he has developed his businesses and significant wealth without conflict with his I never want to do these things again list. Jeff credits the use of psycho-cybernetics techniques, but also emphasizes what he calls accurate thinking, what I have called rational thought, as the all-important starting point. Examine and reevaluate your beliefs. One of the reasons that the power of rational thinking goes unrecognized is that it is so seldom used. Trace down the belief about yourself, about the world, or about other people that is behind your negative behavior. Does something always happen to cause you to miss out just when success seems within your grasp? Perhaps you secretly feel unworthy of success, or that you do not deserve it. Are you ill at ease around other people? Perhaps you believe you are inferior to them, or that other people, per se, are hostile and unfriendly. Do you become anxious and fearful for no good reason in a situation that is relatively safe? Perhaps you believe that the world you live in is a hostile, unfriendly, dangerous place, or that you deserve punishment. How many people do you suppose would love to have a perfect lifestyle business like Jeff's, but, if asked about it, would quickly produce a laundry list of reasons why they cannot do what he has done? These reasons are not reasons based on current rational thought at all. They're just beliefs, subject to change. Remember that both behavior and feeling spring from belief. To root out the belief responsible for your feeling and behavior, ask yourself, why? Is there some task you would like to do, some channel in which you would like to express yourself, but you hang back feeling that I can't? Ask yourself, why? Why do I believe that I can't? Then ask yourself, is this belief based on an actual fact, or on an assumption, or a false conclusion? Then ask yourself these four questions. 1. Is there any rational reason for such a belief? 2. Could it be that I am mistaken in this belief? 3. Would I come to the same conclusion about some other person in a similar situation? 4. Why should I continue to act and feel as if this were true if there's no good reason to believe it? Don't just pass these questions by casually. Wrestle with them. Think hard on them. Get emotional about them. Can you see that you have cheated yourself and sold yourself short not because of a fact, but only because of an irrational and erroneous belief? If so, try to arouse some indignation or even anger. Indignation and anger can sometimes act as liberators from false ideas. Alfred Adler got mad at himself and at his teacher, and he was enabled to throw off a negative definition of himself. This experience is not uncommon. An old farmer said he quit tobacco for good one day when he discovered he had left his tobacco home and started to walk the 2 miles for it. On the way, he saw that he was being used in a humiliating way by a habit. He got mad, turned around, went back to the field, and never smoked again. Clarence Darrow, the famous attorney, said his success started the day that he got mad when he attempted to secure a mortgage for $2,000 to buy a house. Just as the transaction was about to be completed, the lender's wife spoke up and said, "Don't be a fool. He'll never make enough money to pay it off." Darrow himself had had serious doubts about the same thing, but something happened when he heard her remark. He became indignant, both at the woman and at himself, and determined he would be a success. Walt Disney said that he went from exploring ideas to being determined to make a success of them when a group of amusement park owners criticized and laughed at his plans for Disneyland. A businessman friend of mine had a very similar experience. A failure at 40, he continually worried about how things would come out, about his own inadequacies, and whether or not he would be able to complete each business venture. Fearful and anxious, he was attempting to purchase machinery on credit when the man's wife objected. She did not believe he would ever be able to pay for it. At first, his hopes were dashed, but then he became indignant. Who was he to be pushed around like that? Who was he to skulk through the world, continually fearful of failure? The experience awakened something within him, some new self, and at once he saw that this woman's remark, as well as his own opinions of himself, were an affront to this something. He had no money, no credit, and no way to accomplish what he wanted. But he found a way, and within 3 years was more successful than he had ever dreamed of being. Not in one business, but in three. The power of deep desire. Rational thought, to be effective in changing belief and behavior, must be accompanied with deep feeling and desire. Picture to yourself what you would like to be and have, and assume for the moment that such things might be possible. Arouse a deep desire for these things, become enthusiastic about them, dwell on them, and keep going over them in your mind. Your present negative beliefs were formed by thought plus feelings. Generate enough emotion or deep feeling, and your new thoughts and ideas will cancel them out. If you will analyze this, you will see that you are using a process you have often used before. Worry. The only difference is that you change your goals from negative to positive. When you worry, you first picture an undesirable future outcome or goal very vividly in your imagination. You use no effort or willpower, but you keep dwelling on the end result. You keep thinking about it, dwelling on it, picturing it to yourself as a possibility. You play with the idea that it might happen. This constant repetition and thinking in terms of possibilities makes the end result appear more and more real to you. After a time, appropriate emotions are automatically generated: fear, anxiety, discouragement, all appropriate to the undesirable end result you are worrying about. Now, change the goal picture, and you can as easily generate good emotions. Constantly picturing to yourself and dwelling on a desirable end result will also make the possibility seem more real, and again, appropriate emotions of enthusiasm, cheerfulness, encouragement, and happiness will automatically be generated. What rational thought can and cannot do. Remember that your automatic mechanism can as easily function as a failure mechanism as a success mechanism, depending on the data you give it to process and the goals you set for it. It is basically a goal-striving mechanism. The goals it works on are up to you. Many of us unconsciously and unwittingly, by holding negative attitudes and habitually picturing failure to ourselves in our imagination, set up goals of failure. Also remember that your automatic mechanism does not reason about or question the data you feed it. It merely processes it and reacts appropriately to it. The stage fright experienced by people called upon to speak in public is interesting. It is, according to many surveys, one of the top three or four fears shared by all adults. It can be paralyzing. Yet rationally, you can understand that no one has been hanged for giving a poor public speech in quite a long time, at least in this country. In most situations, there is no dire consequence of appearing a bit nervous, forgetting a few points, or telling a joke that falls flat. The fear felt is excessive in relationship to the possible penalty for making mistakes. It is very important that the automatic mechanism be given true facts concerning the environment. This is the job of conscious, rational thought, to know the truth, to form correct evaluations, estimations, opinions. In this connection, Most of us are prone to underestimate ourselves and overestimate the nature of the difficulty facing us. In Why Be Tired, psychologist Daniel W. Josselin wrote, "I have made extensive experiments to discover the common causes of that conscious effort which freezes the thinking mind. Practically always, it seems to be due to the tendency to exaggerate the difficulty and importance of your mental labors, to take them too seriously, and fear they will find you incapable." Unquote. It's just a game. In his book, Golf's Mental Hazards, Overcome Them and Put an End to the Self-Destructive Round, Dr. Alan Shapiro enumerates 6 mental hazards, the first 4 of which are directly relevant to this discussion and have application far beyond the game of golf. Here are his descriptions in abbreviated form. Hazard 1, the fear of fear. Golfers who fall prey to this experience anticipatory anxiety before a round, have first tee jitters, and choke during critical moments. Hazard 2, losing your cool. This is the golfer who slams the club into the ground, throws it into a water hazard, or wraps it around a tree. Hazard 3, getting 2 up or 2 down. These golfers are quick to get down on themselves. Their emotions can range from euphoria after making a difficult par to utter despair after knocking a tee shot out of bounds on the very next hole. On the basis of performance on any given day, these golfers can remain elated or depressed for days after a round of golf. Hazard 4, worry what others think. These individuals dread embarrassment on the golf course, are prone to feelings of inferiority, sensitive to ridicule, and feel that others are always closely watching and judging. Any of these is obviously sufficient to jam the servo mechanism. On analysis, they are, of course, irrational. Hazard 3 is classic overreaction to individual incidents in life, most of which are never as important days or weeks after their occurrence as they seemed at the immediate moment. Persons cursed with the habit of overreaction are one step short of manic depressive, will be profoundly and unnecessarily miserable at least half of their lifetime, will gradually convince their self-image that they have no self-control, and will cause others to avoid relationships with them. And hazard 3 worsens the others. There's a classic golf story about the weekend duffer returning home horribly depressed, sulking and moping about the house until finally his wife says, "Honey, remember it's just a game." He angrily snaps back, "You don't know the first damn thing about golf." But it is just a game, and today is just today. A mistake is just a mistake. We must use rational thinking to achieve perspective, to rise above these paralyzing mental hazards. However, rational thought expressed as willpower, "I will not lose my cool, I will not overreact," is a losing proposition. Rational thought used creatively to develop entirely new mental pictures in the imagination, feeding the self-image dynamic new evidence, transmitting a new target to the servo mechanism, is a winning process. It ain't necessarily so. It is the job of rational conscious thought to examine and analyze incoming messages, to accept those that are true and reject those that are untrue. Many people are bowled over by the chance remark of a friend, "You don't look so well this morning." If they are rejected or snubbed by someone, they blindly swallow the fact that this means they are an inferior person. Most of us are subjected to negative suggestions every day. If our conscious mind is working and on the job, we do not have to accept them blindly. "It ain't necessarily so" is a good motto. In the book Battling the Inner Dummy, the author describes this as limbic hijacking, a sort of abrupt uprising of the automatic failure mechanism that is always lurking about, waiting to wrest control away from both your rational thinking and your automatic success mechanism. After all, the automatic failure mechanism and automatic success mechanism are two sides of the same coin, separated only by the thinnest edge. He wrote, "One of my tennis partners said to me, 'Boy, are you putting on weight?' Within hours, captured by an irrational fear of looking fat, I was on a crash diet. The scale showed I had put on only 3 pounds, but it was the perception of looking fat, rather than the reality, that created the fear. Today, when somebody tells me something like that, I go into the bathroom, close the door, and scream at my inner dummy, 'Don't pay attention to that insensitive remark. Don't get upset. Do you hear me inside there?' So, okay, tonight we'll lay off the mashed potatoes and gravy, but that's it." Unquote. Taking time out for a rational thought coaching session with yourself can be effective and is a precursor to installing rational thought-based mental pictures that can be recalled at a moment's notice to accomplish the same interruption of overreaction. The problem that can't be solved won't be solved. It is the job of the conscious, rational mind to form logical and correct conclusions. I failed once in the past, so I will probably fail in the future, is neither logical nor rational. To conclude I can't in advance without trying, and in the absence of any evidence to the contrary, is not rational. We should be more like the man who was asked if he could play the piano. I don't know, he said. What do you mean you don't know? He said, I've never tried. Michael Vance, the former dean of Disney University, author of the book Think Outside the Box, and an authority on creative thinking, tells of the corporate executive he queried about the company's biggest problem. After listening to the problem described in all its magnitude and severity, Vance asked, Who's working on solving it? No one, replied the executive. Why not? Vance asked. Because it cannot be solved, replied the executive. I imagined that executive saying because it cannot be solved to Mr. Vance in an exasperated, impatient tone, thinking Vance the dolt for not grasping this simple and obvious truth. Too many people live their entire lives just like this executive, believing that their circumstances cannot be improved, their problems cannot be solved, even that somehow they are incapable of achieving the career or success or prosperity or happiness that they see others achieving routinely. As a result, they are as vulnerable to mental hazards unleashing the automatic failure mechanism as a hemophiliac is to paper cuts proving fatal. Decide what you want, not what you don't want. It is the job of conscious, rational thought to decide what you want, select the goals you wish to achieve, and concentrate on these rather than on what you do not want. Once you have arrived at an understanding of what you want, spending time and effort concentrating on what you do not want is not rational. When President Eisenhower was General Eisenhower in World War II, he was asked what would have been the effect on the Allied cause if the invasion troops had been thrown back into the sea from the beaches of Italy. It would have been very bad, he said, but I never allow my mind to think in that way. How do you let your mind think? Most people go about their daily business exercising no control whatsoever over what pops into or is popped into their minds. Television, radio, the newspaper, casual conversation, overheard conversation, any critical remark, even an advertising billboard, takes control. A cumbersome but illuminating exercise is to carry a pad or bound notebook with you all day and jot down every thought that occurs to you. Take a look at this diary at the end of the day and see for yourself how little of what you thought you chose to think. We are too often like the couch potato whose TV remote control battery goes dead and too lazy to go and install a new battery. He simply sits there all evening watching whatever comes on the station he is stuck on. Can't you do better than this? Keep your eye on the ball. It is the job of your conscious mind to pay strict attention to the task at hand, to what you are doing, and what is going on around you, so that these incoming sensory messages can keep your automatic mechanism currently advised of the environment and allow it to respond spontaneously. In baseball parlance, you must keep your eye on the ball. It is not the job of your conscious rational mind, however, to create or to do the job at hand. We get into trouble when we either neglect to use conscious thinking in the way that it is meant to be used, or when we attempt to use it in a way that it was never meant to be used. We cannot squeeze creative thought out of the creative mechanism by making a conscious effort. We cannot do the job to be done by making strained conscious efforts. And because we try and cannot, we become concerned, anxious, frustrated. The automatic mechanism is unconscious. We cannot see the wheels turning. We cannot know what is taking place beneath the surface. And because it works spontaneously in reacting to present and current needs, we can have no intimation or certified guarantee in advance that it will come up with the answer. We are forced into a position of trust, and only by trusting and acting do we receive signs and wonders. In short, conscious rational thought selects the goal, gathers information, concludes, evaluates, estimates, and starts the wheels in motion. It is not, however, responsible for results. We must learn to do our work, act on the best assumptions available, and leave the results to take care of themselves. Try these mental training exercises. 1. Have a heart-to-heart talk with yourself, and honestly assess whether you have any problems you're no longer attempting to resolve only because you've accepted as fact that they cannot be solved. Whether you are living out circumstances in your life that are unfulfilling or even demeaning to you because you have accepted as fact that you cannot alter them. Reconsider. Apply current rational thought to challenge these beliefs, and then use your imagination to shop around and try out new and different possibilities. Consider the questions I suggested in this chapter about each of these facts you uncover in your heart-to-heart. Why do I believe that I can't? Then ask yourself, is this belief based on actual fact or on an assumption or false conclusion? Is there any rational reason for such a belief? Could it be that I am mistaken in this belief? Would I come to the same conclusion about some other person in a similar situation? Why should I continue to act and feel as if this were true if there's no good reason to believe it? 2. Out of all this rational thought, you may identify a new target or goal to assign your automatic success mechanism. If so, review the exercises provided at the end of each of the prior chapters as a means of getting started. Summary checklist of the uses of rational thought. 1. It is the job of rational, conscious thought to examine and analyze incoming messages, to accept those that are true, and to reject those that are untrue. 2. It is the job of the conscious, rational mind to form logical and correct conclusions. 3. It is the job of conscious, rational thought to decide what you want, select the goals you wish to achieve, and concentrate on these rather than on what you do not want. 4. It is the job of your conscious mind to pay strict attention to the task at hand, to what you are doing and what is going on around you, so that these incoming sensory messages can keep your automatic mechanism currently advised of the environment and allow it to respond spontaneously. Chapter 6. How to Relax and Let Your Automatic Success Mechanism Work for You. Abraham Lincoln wrote, "Determine that the thing can and shall be done, and then we shall find the way." Stress has recently become a popular word in our language. We speak of this as the age of stress. Worry, anxiety, insomnia, stomach ulcers have become accepted as a necessary part of the world in which we live. I wrote that in 1960. In 1960, we didn't know what stress was. We did not have the incessant cacophony of cellular phones, beepers, email, and other technologies keeping us constantly accessible, constantly communicating, constantly under pressure to respond to everyone instantly. We could never have foreseen the collapse of middle management in most corporate cultures, forcing each person to do the work of three. We did not even yet have the two-career household as a norm. Today, the typical person has less leisure time, much less private recovery time, longer and more congested commutes, a much greater and faster flow of information, and a more complex environment to deal with. It is far more critical today to conquer stress and anxiety and to exert control over your life than it was when I first began talking about psychocybernetics as stress management. I remain convinced that life need not be relentless pressure and stress. We could relieve ourselves of a vast load of care, anxiety, and worry if we could but recognize the simple truth that our Creator made ample provisions for us to live successfully in this or any other age by providing us with a built-in creative mechanism. Changes in society or technology can easily be handled by our infinitely capable servo mechanism. In fact, it does not understand the meaning of being overworked or stressed out because its capacity is unlimited. Our trouble is that we ignore the automatic creative mechanism and try to do everything and solve all our problems by conscious thought or willpower. It is the job of the conscious mind to pose problems and to identify them, but by its very nature, it was never engineered to solve problems itself. You pile on stress by striving to do it all. You relieve stress by learning to assign problems to your automatic success mechanism, then letting go of them.